Our next speaker is Alan Dickin, and he is going to be letting us know why we need to re-examine the day-age interpretation of Genesis 1. Alan, thank you.
Okay, thank you. I just want to say that I didn't really plan to use the animation scheme, but the computer is forcing me to do that, so excuse my clicking through a bunch of items to bring up each slide. So I'm going to kind of pick up where Hugh Ross left off. So I decided to start off by discussing the background of biblical concordance. So I'll quote from Hugh. Concordance seek agreement between properly interpreted scripture passages that describe some aspects of the natural realm and indisputably and well-established data in science. I think that's a great proposal, and in principle, I think concordism is a noble enterprise. However, I do think that there is good concordism and bad concordism. So, according to my definition, good concordism finds agreement between the biblical account and real events that actually happened, whereas bad concordism attempts to fit the biblical account to events that either didn't happen or didn't happen in a recognizable form or happened at some other time instead. So now I want to look at the day-age theory and, is this good concordism or bad concordism? So a quick definition of the day-age theory, it's a general understanding, I think everyone would agree with it. The day-age theory tries to reconcile biblical and scientific views by arguing that the creation days were not 24-hour days, but actually lasted for long periods of time, or as the theory's name implies, days each lasted an age. And I'm going to look at the day-age theory in terms of two models from Arnold Guyot and Hugh Ross. And this, of course, is Arnold Guyot on the left, and Hugh Ross, you know what he looks like. excuse my just running down here because I want to put it all up at once. In the preface to his 1884 book, Guyot admits that there have been many previous versions of the day-age theory, and I don't have the resources to follow the history of all those previous versions, but here's one of the most well-established, which is why I'm focusing on it. So it has had a long previous history, but he proposes a new version, which he claims to have received or had based on an idea he had 40 years earlier. Quote, many attempting to make the great periods of geology to correspond to the six created days fail to see that Moses confines the whole of paleontological geology from the beginning of life in the Cambrian and Silurian up to the tertiary and quaternary ages within the fifth and sixth cosmogonic days. Note the phrase I highlighted in blue, fail to see. This is a classic example of what's called begging the question. It's a warning against allowing rhetoric to overshadow the facts available. Those who fail to see it, they only fail to see it if, in fact, the proposal was correct in the first place. And, I'm hopefully going to show you that it wasn't. So let's focus on the content, which is on the right-hand side. Now, the key point, which Hugh Ross has already alluded to, is the thorny question, which has exercise interpreted since origin, that plants appear on day 3, the sun and moon appear on day 4. And essentially, Guyot's model, again, it's based on the fact that the sun and moon first became visible on day 4, and as a result, since it appeared to him that the atmosphere became transparent early in Earth history, then he was forced to basically place the history of the universe over the first 4 days. In other words, he stretched out the first 4 days to apply to the early history of the universe. Now, so let me demonstrate how that works. So we'll start off with Genesis 1:2. The earth was formless and empty, darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. He's going to reinterpret the Hebrew word that we translate earth, Eretz, if I can pronounce it like that. In the second verse, Eretz is an equivalent for matter in general. We feel justified in understanding Eretz in this early stage in the history of the universe as meaning the primordial cosmic material out of which God's Spirit brooded upon the waters was going to organize the universe and the earth. In other words, he translates what he understands Eretz to mean cosmic dust. And of course, the brooding upon the waters, he doesn't regard that as water, but as cosmic water vapor. Now the problem, of course, is that if we look at the usage of the word elsewhere in the Old Testament, we find normally it actually means land. Earth is only the secondary meaning. And therefore, it's a big stretch to say it means intergalactic dust clouds. Okay, so let's look at a couple of other key verses, day 3 and day 4. God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit and seed in it. Well, basically, because of the way that Guyot has squashed the Earth history, his solution to this has to be the plant isn't really a form of life, it's half life. And that's how it can appear early in Earth history. And that is in comparison with his understanding of how the sun and moon became visible. During the age of matter, that is before life, the intensity of chemical action was a source of permanent light. The Earth was self-luminous, the sun, moon, and stars being merged into the stronger light from the Earth. But after the disappearance of the luminous envelope, the sun and moon became visible. Okay, so I'm just going to bring all these up together. I think we can agree that Guyot's interpretation is problematical in the light of more recent science. What I want to do now is to compare it with Hugh Ross's version of the day-age theory, and the key point of comparison is this account on day 4 of the atmosphere, the appearance of the sun and moon, which is taken to mean the atmosphere became transparent. So let's examine how that works. Oh, I should just basically say, of course, Hugh Ross's conception of the creation days is the Earth was already in existence on day 0, I'm calling it day 0, the beginning, very much different from Guyot. So again, we have a quote of Genesis 1:2, and I quote from Hugh Ross here. Earth's atmosphere and interplanetary debris prevents the light of the sun and the stars from reaching the surface of the Earth's ocean. The ocean covers the whole surface of the Earth. Okay, so the question is, was there a time when Earth's atmosphere and interplanetary debris could prevent the sun's light from reaching the Earth's surface? The answer is yes, immediately after the giant moon-forming impact, which he referred to. So this is a model of the giant impact from Cut and Stewart 2012. On the left-hand side, you see a picture, a model of the Earth, this is a numerical model, immediately after the impact, 40 minutes after the impact, in fact. The Earth's core is blue, the Earth's mantle is green, it's being blown into space, and the impactor is red. It's joining the Earth's core, a lot of it, and the rest of it is blown into space. Now, then we have a second view after 2 days. The blue represents the Earth being entirely molten. The green represents material orbiting the Earth, some of which will form the moon, and the yellow is a rock, is an atmosphere made of rock vapor. So, how is this going to tie in with Hugh's model of the day-age theory? God said, let there be light. God cleared away most interplanetary debris and partially transformed Earth's atmosphere, making it translucent so that light from the heavenly bodies could penetrate the surface of Earth's ocean. So this is a model. This is a reconstruction from a recent paper, Palavine et al. 2011. It shows how this process might have occurred. You have a cloud, which is raining droplets, but you have to realize the cloud is made of rock vapor, and the droplets are magma, a rain of magma, and the ocean below is an ocean of magma, liquid rock. So you must judge for yourself whether this scenario can be reconciled with the account of the spirit brooding over the ocean in first chapter of Genesis. So now let's look a little bit at plants, appearing on day three. I won't recite the text again. So according to Ross's model, basically the creation of plants is pretty much as recorded in the fossil record, I believe. So for example, the oldest land fossils date to 475 million years. The oldest known tree fossil, 385 million years. So this would be in the Paleozoic. How is this going to tie in with day four? Okay, so on the fourth creation day, the skies change from translucent to transparent, from overcast to clear. So we have to ask, how would this have occurred? So on the left-hand side is the water cycle. Ocean water evaporates to produce cloud. And if we cannot see the sun and moon, then the clouds must have 100% coverage, it's overcast. So when could the overcast skies first have been cleared? Well, I'm going to say that they must have cleared during the Earth's first major glaciation, because when you cover the sea with ice, you cut off evaporation, and then before you cut off the supply of water vapor to make clouds. So let's just look at the evidence for first major glaciation. It's more than 2 billion years old. It's recorded in Attilite, which is a terrestrial glacial deposit on the left, which is the a rock flower matrix containing floating clasts, which is attributed to glacial erosion. And a more persuasive piece of evidence on the right-hand side, this is an example of what are called drop stones in a laminated argillite. A laminated argillite must be deposited far from the coast because it's a very fine grained sediment. When we find large clasts in that fine-grained sediment, the only model we know of is floating icebergs which contain eroded rock pebbles and then drop them onto the sea floor. So this is strong evidence for substantial glacial cover in more than 2 billion years ago. And of course, you've probably all heard about the snowball Earth theory, which argues that the Earth was almost entirely covered in ice in the late Proterozoic. So just have a quick look here at a model, climate model from Bauman Crowley, and this is a model for the cloud cover during snowball Earth, which is to say the black line at the bottom is a ice-covered southern continent, the rest of the Earth is ocean, and what you see on the right-hand side is a scale showing cloud cover, and what you see is that this model predicts that the equator would have a large amount of cloud cover, but the poles would be almost clear. So, to me, the geological evidence is not in accord with the day age model, because we have still the problem that plants are appearing before the atmosphere is clear, whereas the geological evidence I see is that the atmosphere cleared before the appearance of plants. What I want to ask is there an alternative? Well, what's my alternative proposal to get to offer you? So the alternative proposal here is the key word is the words of creation spoken by God. When God said, "Let there be light," a quote from Augustine, when God said, "Let there be light," and the light was made, what language did he speak? And what was the need of fleeting sounds where there was no bodily sense appearing? My reaction to that is, well, the words of creation were spoken to a man. This is the key point of the story. So now I'm quoting from John Walton. The material phase, by which he means the creation of the universe. The material phase could have been under development for long eras. These were like the rehearsals leading up to the performance of a play. They find their meaning only when the audience is present. It is then that the play exists, and it's for them that the play exists. In other words, this play is the revelation of Genesis chapter 1 to man. What would the observer have seen in these 7 days of Genesis 1, asked Walton? The observer would see day by day that everything was ready to do for people what it had been designed to do. So now let's have a look at briefly at the cosmic temple theory, at my summary. The first 3 days established the functioning of the cosmic temple. The next 3 days installed the functionaries, but the 7th day is the most important. On that day, God takes up residence in his cosmic temple. So Walton goes on to say, without hesitation, the ancient reader would conclude that this is a temple text. So this is more than just saying that the cosmos is a temple. It's saying the story of creation is specifically attached to a temple, a functioning temple. So what is this temple? Well, most people would believe that this was written long before the Jerusalem temple, or at least the first version of this, because we believe that Moses received some kind of account, and therefore it predates the Jerusalem temple. So was this the tabernacle, which Moses presided over, as it were, in the wilderness? Well, the key point here to assess this is the 4th command. In 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, but he rested on the 7th day, therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. The reference to the creation week as the basis for the Sabbath implies the story was already known to the Israelites, because it was the justification, and therefore implies they were familiar with the justification. Also, the Sabbath is presented as an institution that already existed because, if you recall, in the gathering of manna, they're instructed to collect 2 days' worth of manna, and this was before the law was given. Finally, there's a lot of emphasis in John Walton that summarizes this in the functioning of the cosmic temple, meaning the earth, to produce food in terms of the daily cycle, the weather, and growing food. This is partly consistent with being in the desert where the Israelites were eating manna. Okay, so this is my final point then. So I'm going to argue that the Genesis text, if it's a temple text, it must be an earlier temple text. Well, where was that? That was in Mesopotamia. This is where Abraham came from, and therefore he could have brought the story of creation from Mesopotamia. The Sumerians were worshipping the God of heaven more than 2,000 years before the Israelites. Sumerian religion became corrupt, of course, but it's worthy of investigation. Or rather, I should say, this is the beginning of a very long story about which many books should be written, but that the origins of a temple text comprising Genesis 1 could go back much further into the early human history than most people are aware of, and This is worthy of detailed investigation. So my objective really here today is to try and convince the audience that questioning the earliest history of this text and whether it could possibly have arisen in Mesopotamia is worthy of further study. Thank you.
It's probably not unprecedented in our meetings, but it is uncommon to have one speaker be the subject of another speaker's talk. So I thought we might use a little bit of our question time to give you just 1 or 2 minutes maybe to comment or respond on this. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Just a couple minutes. Let's keep it real short so we maybe have some questions still.
Sure. You'll see this in, I guess this is not. I can go up there. Okay.
You'll see this in Navigating Genesis, that there are papers that have been published that now tell us that vegetation was abundant on the land masses at least 1.2 billion years ago, and maybe even earlier. It's challenging to come up with evidence plants simply because of the fact that they don't fossilize easily. In fact, all they have found is isotope evidence and fossil parts. And recognize, too, that the Hebrew word that's used for vegetation, deshah, is a general term. When you see the seeds, fruits, and trees, those are examples of a deshah. The other thing is that there's more than one way to have clouds covering the earth. Water vapor would be the way it would have to happen today. But if you're going back a billion years and earlier, we know this is that carbon dioxide is far more abundant in the atmosphere than it is today. And that's some of the research I was referring to. And you'll see this in this new book I'm bringing, Improbable Planet, analysis of the early chemistry of the Earth's atmosphere. So in that sense, it is credible that indeed we don't have the clearing of the atmosphere where the sun that existed becomes visible to creatures on the Earth until day 5. As for John Walton, you'll see on our website at reasons.org a fairly lengthy critique that I have written of his book, The Lost World of Genesis 1. I had a chance to engage John himself on that, asked him what he thought. He said, well, of all the reviews that have been written on my book, yours is the longest, but it's also the fairest. So he did appreciate the fact that I quoted him in context every time. But anyway, you can check that out. Just Google John Walton's name on our website. It'll pop right up for you. Thanks.
Alan, do you? Should we open up for questions?
Yes.
Or
yes,
do you want to say anything?
No,
okay.
I don't need to. No.
Any questions? And maybe students first? Anybody a student? Yeah, go ahead.
What was the question?
Okay, so it goes back to the question about the atmosphere clearing relative to plants. Well, so my argument was that I think that the Huronian glaciation, which is about 2.2 billion years, was extensive. It's generally assumed that the Snowball Earth glaciation, which would be 800 million years or so, was more extensive. The question you would need to address is to what extent you think that terrestrial plants predate one or other of those glaciations. As Hugh says, we don't have detailed fossil evidence, but there is a possibility that the forerunners of plants could have been on continents at an earlier time than plant fossils. It's for you to decide to what extent you are willing to accommodate those kinds of concepts in terms of forerunners as the reality of the biblical description.
In the back, go ahead.
So as scientists, we're under attack by much of academia because they think we're checking our brains at the door, and that's a pretty brutal thing. But when we're talking about creation science, we come under a lot of attack from the church itself. So I was just wondering how you kind of cope with or deal with or just remain steadfast in this line of work when you're kind of being like bombarded from both sides.
Okay, my wife often asks me, what's the point, of pursuing these arguments, because the man in the street doesn't care about the details. My answer, if that's paraphrasing your question, maybe in a sort of way, my answer is that we have to establish what the truth as we see it first before we're ready to take that truth to the man in the street. Excuse my expression. So I believe that when we've done our research, I believe in that trickle down. Just to put it quickly, research has to trickle down to the person in the street gradually, but it's important that we assemble a detailed model first, and then we can gradually try to convince the population that our model is correct. So it's a long-term process. That's the best I can say, I think.
Yeah, go ahead. So how would the original author have viewed what she was writing?
Okay, so...
how they understood themselves.
Yes. The word writing could be a loaded word because... the person who received this revelation, we don't know who that was. We barely should speculate, but I put that person back into the distant past. I put this person in Mesopotamia because this is where Abraham came from, and I believe Abraham did receive a substantial revelation of the character of God in Mesopotamia, albeit in a culture which was largely apostate. But I do believe that Genesis says that there was a continuity of the revelation of God that began in the ancient past in Mesopotamia, and it was carried through Abraham to Israel.
And so they would have viewed it as the rest of the ancient Near East viewed creation.
What we see is a corrupted version. I like to think that Abraham somehow recovered and that an uncorrupted version of the account of creation. I can come up with a way this could have happened. I wouldn't have time, but I'd be happy to discuss it with anyone ad nauseam, in fact.
Considering that science still seems to be changing, at least on a decadal level, the great impact of Jupiter and all that, fairly recent. The snowball Earth is maybe 20 years old. Can Concordism yet be done? Because we expect now in another 20 years to have some other major scientific fact that needs to be accounted for by an invariant scripture, rightly so. So can we ever do it and never be sure that we're done and saying the truth?
Maybe you should ask him that.
I don't want to do what you can.
No, I would see there's an advancing enterprise. It's kind of like, how we're learning about gravity. There's certain things that we appreciate that are very well established, but in the research literature, we're still questioning the fine points of gravity. We're still going to be questioning the fine points, but we know we're on the right track where our adjustments are getting smaller and smaller. They're getting bigger and bigger when we know we make an interpretation mistake. And we should always expect to be learning more about scripture than learning more about the book of nature. So in that sense, the enterprise will never end.
Well, yeah, because we seem to be rearranging days and what happens.
Well, we're rearranging days, we've got a problem.
Yeah.
If we're doing just fine adjustments, okay.
I see myself as a concordist of a kind, so in that sense, Hugh and I are on the same page, although we have different models. We still believe in concordism, which is to say that we should try to reconcile the real history of the Earth with what we read in Scripture.
Time for one last question. Go ahead.
Stand up, so everyone can hear me. I'm not sure I quite understand what you mean. You talk about Genesis 1 as being a temple text that needs to be read in a particular ancient Near Eastern context. that seems to preclude scientific concordance. Because if it's a temple text, it means it's not literal history. It's not to be interpreted as scientific account.
Okay, well, I was using the word concordance, perhaps a bit loosely. I'm talking about the concordism of the Bible as a whole compared with the book of God's creation, or whatever it's called, the natural world. So, okay, I'm not a strict concordist on Genesis 1, but I'm going to be a concordist on Genesis 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, perhaps. It's a complicated story. Thank you.
Let's thank Alan one more time.